Your Honor, I'm William J. McDonald on behalf of claimant. The main issue on this appeal, there's several issues, but the primary issue is the testimony, or not testimony, the report of Dr. Burton, which is what the ALJ relied on in denying this claim. Dr. Burton made a statement, quote, this is not a work-related injury, even though the patient was at work. The patient's status and shoulder injury would have been exactly the same had he not been at work. Then he went on to specifically explain his reasoning in the same paragraph, and this is page 384 of the record, third paragraph. The fracture would clearly have occurred whether or not he had performed the activity of reaching back for the seatbelt. The patient's occupational activity did not cause the patient's fracture. The fracture occurred simply as it would inevitably have done due to the weakened state of the bone while the patient was performing a type of activity which is performed equally at work and off work, and thus the fracture of the humerus cannot, in my assessment, as an occupational position, be regarded from the medical perspective as an occupational injury or work-related problem. That last sentence destroys the preceding parts of his testimony. Number one, this is not a medical perspective at all. He's playing amateur lawyer, and he's talking about what's probably called proximate causation better than anything else, saying this type of an accident isn't something the law should cover, at least in his opinion.
Counsel, couldn't we, I'm assuming you're right that he's playing amateur lawyer, couldn't we simply disregard this, that part of the sentence that says, thus the fracture of the humerus cannot, in my assessment as an occupational physician, be regarded from the medical perspective as an occupational injury or work-related problem? Is that what you're asking us to do, is to disregard his legal,
yes,
what you're calling a legal conclusion? But can't we pay attention to the remainder of the paragraph?
I don't believe so, because the duty of the trial court is to judge this case on the record, and that's part of the record. When he specifically gives his reasoning, that's what he's saying. That's his testimony, in effect. We can't just pick out words and phrases and say, well, these words and phrases sound like they add up to substantial evidence, and we'll disregard the rest.
Assume that the doctor's opinion was that the injury would have occurred anyway. In other words, if it didn't occur that moment when he was in the car on company business, it would have occurred the next week when he was back at home with his wife in the car. Assume that's what his opinion was.
Yes.
Would that be sufficient to sustain the judgment below?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
What matters is, what was the last straw that broke the camel's back, and was it related to the job duties? I mean, it would have happened. Obviously, the lytic lesion was very advanced in this arm. It broke with just reaching back for his seatbelt. Much like in the H&H Warehouse versus Vickery case, Mr. Vickery had a tumor in his humerus, and he was at work, and his boss played a practical joke on him, and nothing else was happening at the warehouse. He hit the button to jerk open the big steel clanky door where the truck's backed up to, and Vickery went like this, and his arm snapped in midair. Really nothing different between the Vickery case and this case. It was a minor event at work, which had major ramifications due to the weakened state of the arm. But if it would have happened a week later, it's irrelevant.
Well, let's assume it would have happened the same day. I mean, what I understand you to be saying is, it's simply a matter of where he was at the time that the injury occurred, and whether he did some physical activity at that time.
And if it had
happened that morning when he rolled over in bed, he wouldn't have been, I mean, I think you would say that he would not have been covered.
Yes, he would have, because he was in travel status.
Okay, so you have the travel status, sorry, I understand that.
And if it would have happened a week later, he'd still be in Hawaii.
Let's assume he wasn't in travel status at that time.
Well, if he's not in travel status, then rolling over in bed wouldn't be compensable.
So it's purely a question of fortuity when it happens under your analysis, correct?
Well, it matters. I wouldn't say pure fortuity. That just sounds like the wrong word. But I mean, it either happened due to something that arose from work, or it didn't, and in this case, it did. And Dr. Burton made it crystal clear, his analysis was, what happened at work was something that happens every day, time after time, on the job, off the job, and thus, it cannot be regarded as an occupational injury. That's his specific reasoning. And that reasoning has no basis in Colorado law, none.
Is it your position that if he's in travel status, that the fact that he's in travel status completely eliminates the requirement of a causal connection between the employment and the injury?
Well, let me find the case. The Birch versus Lynch Energy Service, it says the burden is on the employer to show the claimant made a departure from the scope of employment while in travel status. But when you're in travel status, even ministering to personal needs, going out for lunch, rolling over in bed, slipping in the shower, all of that stuff is covered. You are covered continuously.
Mr. McDonald, I'm looking at the statute that you quoted regarding travel status, 841-204, and it talks about an employee who has been injured, blah, blah, receives personal injuries in an accident arising out of and in the course of such employment outside this state. Doesn't that arising out of suggest, and contrary perhaps to that Birch case, that there is still some sort of a causal connection required? I'm looking at
it. It could, but it doesn't matter, because this happened when he was putting the seatbelt on to resume his trip back to the Pearl Harbor base.
So you're saying
call from his boss.
It necessarily was arising out of his employment here,
yes,
because it was an act performed specifically in response to.
Yes.
Some of the older cases talk about the need to have some kind of special hazard, presumably distinguishing from just an everyday action. Was that the law? Is that no longer the law?
No, it is no longer the law. In H&H Warehouse versus Vickery, which is the prime case in Colorado, 1990, essentially a quarter of a century ago, he was startled at work by a practical joke, basically. That could happen anywhere. It had nothing almost to do with his work.
But we're not bound by H&H. I mean, do you contend apart from H&H that that result is compelled?
Yes. Well, H&H is the law in Colorado. I don't think when the legislature has left that decision untouched for 24 years and the Supreme Court denied cert, I don't think there's any reason, none's been given, to change that law. I mean, every case that comes up isn't just a brand new case to start from scratch.
You cite several ICAO cases that appear to follow H&H Warehouse. Are you aware of any other published decisions that follow H&H? I'm wondering if it is an anomaly in Colorado, given those older cases that talk about the need for a special hazard.
Published cases. I can't think of published cases. I believe there are about 150 ICAP decisions where H&H Warehouse is cited. The majority of those are cases where something happened at work to act on a pre-existing condition to cause an injury, and they were compensable.
Mr. McDonald, was the ALJ required to credit the claimant's testimony that the cracking sound reflected the breaking of the bone?
Well, nobody attacked it. Nobody discredited it. He didn't say, I think the claimant's lying. And it's consistent with what he immediately reported to his supervisor and the ER records at the Kaiser facility on the lot. I mean, that wasn't even an issue.
In the posture of the case, Mr. McDonald, as I understand, there were simply reports that were submitted. None of the experts actually testified. Is that right?
Correct.
So we don't know whether the experts you're relying on would have. We don't even know if they saw Dr.
Burton's
report.
I think he interviewed the claimant. I don't know if he really did any kind of physical exam.
No, I'm sorry, I misspoke. We don't know whether any of the other physicians had read Dr. Burton's report, do we?
No.
So,
but again, that
you did not present testimony stating that his opinions were not supported by scientific theory or were contrary to all natural law.
No, because
those are your conclusions, right?
It's his reasoning, his own reasoning.
No, it's your conclusions about his reasoning, not any expert opinion.
No, but his reasoning precludes this kind of denial under Colorado law. He's given a reason for what he said that has no basis in Colorado law. It cannot form the basis of a denial. And the ALJ and the panel were bound by H&H Warehouse. In the other cases I cited, Elkis and Pappas, those were cases where statements made by, in one case, the deceased, in one case by the claimant, that were flatly contrary to what he was saying in court, were just simply overthrown. They were thrown out. They had no evidentiary value whatsoever because they were overwhelmed by the rest of the record. In the Wecker case, this court, 1995, said evidence can be disregarded if it constitutes a mere conclusion. To take Dr. Burton's statement, oh, this had nothing to do with what he did at work, that's a mere conclusion. There's no explanation, no nothing. It's a mere conclusion. If you try to pull that out separately and just disregard everything else, when you read it in the context of his report, it's crystal clear what he's saying. He's saying, this can't be covered. This is not a compensable injury. And that's A, not within his expertise, and B, completely contrary to H&H Warehouse. Now, if we wanted to have a case where a bone just separated on its own without any kind of force acting on it, I put in my brief, you put the guy in an induced medical coma, you tie him down gently to a table, give him some curare so there's no muscle movement, and eventually the two parts of the bone will, for lack of a better term, grow apart. And you'll have two parts of a bone. That didn't happen here. Mr. Duran had no pain before the fracture. He didn't know he had multiple myeloma or a lytic lesion in his humerus. He didn't know any of this was a problem until the moment it snapped. And then it hurt a lot. And then he went into the surgery and all the rest of it. And the importance of that is there is no evidence to suggest he wasn't using his arm in a normal manner. Driving, getting in and out of the truck, shifting, turning, doing all the things that you do on his job. And his arm was perfectly capable of standing up to it until that moment when he reached back for the seatbelt and it snapped.
Suppose the break had occurred, he's driving along, he's got his hands on the steering wheel, he doesn't reach back, he doesn't do anything other than keep his hands on the steering wheel, but somehow, because of his illness, the bone spontaneously breaks. Would your position be the same?
That's impossible. Whether it's a bone, a femur, a humerus, a pencil, or a telephone pole, or a toothpick, it only fractures when more force is placed on it than it can withstand. That's the only time it fractures.
But that sounds like a matter of science. You say it's impossible. How do we know that's impossible?
Because I think everybody's popped a toothpick or a popsicle stick. I don't think this takes a PhD to explain that.
No, but I mean, when you're moving the steering wheel, it doesn't take a lot of force, but there's some. So my hypothetical is that he's just driving the car, doesn't turn around, doesn't do anything other than drive the car, but because his bone is so weak, that extremely small force of turning the steering wheel breaks his arm.
Okay.
Would your position be the same?
Absolutely.
As it is today? Yes?
The case law is crystal clear, and I cited this. This is from Larson. we do not weigh the relative contribution. We don't talk about the first cause or second cause or big cause or little cause or main cause or minor cause. If there was a contribution to the fracture from what happened, what arose from work, this is compensable, period, end of discussion.
Thank you. Can you see the little buttons down there for...
Yeah, I see you want me to listen. Thank you, Mr. Court, counsel. My name is Kate Malroy. I'm the attorney for the respondents in the underlying case below the appellee today. With all due respect, I disagree with the position that has been given to you by the appellate. First of all, the review that is appropriate here is not de novo. It's not the ALJ's use of discretion, and this applies to the law below. I don't believe he did. Dr. Burton's opinion was not the only evidence that supported that this was a pathological fracture that broke, in essence, spontaneously in this individual. There were diagnostic studies, x-rays, to the medical opinions that were proffered, as well as subsequent to this particular incident, there were two other fractures in the claimant's spine that commenced or had the same sort of problem where they just spontaneously fractured with this disease process. So our position initially is the review should be that or whether or not the ALJ abused discretion and misapplied the law. We don't believe that he did.
Did you challenge below the evidence that there was this cracking sound when the driver turned around and was putting on the seatbelt? Did you challenge the credibility of that testimony?
The question was what happened to the claimant to testify as to what happened. I wasn't there. My expert wasn't there. There was no basis to contradict what he said happened at the time. The issue to me is medical. What caused the fracture? What was going on medically with the claimant at the time? What did the doctors diagnose? And what ultimately was the prognosis and outcome of the result? The doctors opine that the disease process he has no known cause. They don't know what caused multiple myeloma. And that what he had was a pathologic fracture. And that means, in essence, that it just fractures. Dr. Burton testified in his report that it would have occurred with or without any force to the claimant's extremity. So whether he was moving his arm at the steering wheel, sitting in a chair quietly at home, it wouldn't have mattered, it would have fractured. And that is the distinction between this case and the H&H case. I do want to touch a little bit.
Wait, I'm sorry, could you just stop for a minute? I'm really troubled about this H&H case. First of all, you would distinguish this situation from H&H.
Yes.
Because there, the claimant suddenly turned at the sound of a slamming door, as I recall. And here, he turned to pull his seatbelt on. I'm not understanding that distinction.
Of course. The distinction that I see is, in the H&H case, the claimant had a movement that was not contradicted that caused him to aggravate an underlying non-occupational condition. In this case, the doctor has testified that no activity he did would have caused the fracture to occur. It simply happened as a pathologic fracture. So the evidence was from Dr. Burton, whether or not he moved his arm at all, it wouldn't have mattered. The fracture would have happened.
So you would disagree with Mr. McDonald's example of a toothpick or whatever it was, popsicle stick, that it couldn't break absent some activity.
I would, and I'm not an expert medically at all. I have no idea. I mean, I'm speculating as much as he is. But, you know, certainly the human body has weight. The bones have weight. You have gravity, muscle tone in the body that whether or not you're moving or at rest, there's going to be some sort of, if you want to call it movements, something that would cause your bones to have potentially friction. I don't know about this disease process, but if the doctors indicate that the literature says that these fractures occur, in essence, spontaneously, then I have no reason to disagree with that. And I certainly wouldn't supplement my opinion for that of an expert.
Does it matter when it would have occurred? In other words, we know, or we think we know, that it did occur at that moment because the claimant testified that he heard the popping sound. So We have that information. Is it sufficient for you to avoid liability if it would have happened at some point, but not at that point?
I think the issue is really the causal analysis that you have to make. You know, the Popovich case, which is an old case from the Court of Appeals a long time ago, that's been upheld.
Say that case again.
Popovich versus Orlando, P-O-P-O-V-I-C-H versus I-R-L-A-N-D-O. Long-standing case on compensability. You have to prove as a claimant that there is an injury in the course and scope of employment arising out of and causally related to the damages sustained. And those are always required, whether you're on travel status, whether you're in the employment's in their facility working for the employer, whatever the case may be, it has to be those three elements met. There has been over time exceptions wherein an aggravation can be determined to be enough to cause the injury to be work-related. And in some of these cases cited by plaintiff or by Mr. McDonald, the causation analysis is simply, well, while this wasn't a work-related condition underneath, on top of that, we aggravated it by an occupational condition. So a knee sprain in the workplace that results in causing an occupational back problem to be problematic is then compensable. An occupational jolting in the workplace that causes a non-occupational disease process to become active is then compensable. To me, it's carving out more exceptions to more of a strict liability standard, frankly, for the work comp carrier, but I think at least you have a causal connection component in those cases. If you were to find this case compensable based on the opinion that there was no need for any activity at all to cause this fracture, and yet because he was in the workplace, that's enough, it's work-related, you make it a strict liability standard. And then every time a person is in the workplace and anything at all happens, even if it's spontaneous, the carrier is then liable for medical damages, permanent impairment, lost wages, disfigurements, everything well beyond any health carrier that would pay for any kind of coverage or go to health coverage. So I think you expand liability and you expand expense to the employer in having your work comp coverage, and they don't want to pay that premium to come and into Colorado. So that gives less chills of your effect of businesses in Colorado.
But I think you'd be right in that argument if the claimant hadn't done or performed any physical act that the record, so far as we know, shows was the event that whether it would have happened otherwise, it did happen at that point. So I think your parade of horribles about making this entirely strict liability, I'm not sure I accept that given this factual record.
Well, I think what I'm relying on in this case is the fact that the ALJ determined the credibility of witnesses and determined the facts that supported the ultimate order that he issued. And he determined that the evidence from Dr. Burnton, which was with or without anything occurring in the workplace, without any stress at all, the fracture could have occurred, is an unknown origins to how this disease process occurs, and there was no proof medically that anything he did caused this shoulder or humerus fracture. I think that's different than someone testifying, you definitely had an ankle sprain, but the ankle sprain is different than a non-occupational back injury. We know the ankle sprain happened, we can see it enough to do it in those kinds of cases. In this case, you have a doctor and an ALJ finding that credible, that that particular movement, whether it happened or not, isn't what caused the fracture to the shoulder. And that's the difference, as I see it.
I take it, given the evidence, I mean, Dr. Brenton says the fracture would clearly have occurred whether or not he had performed the activity of reaching back for the seatbelt. So given that evidence, if the way the injury occurred was Mr. Duran had tripped over a piece of equipment while on the work site, fallen, and his arm broke at that point in time, would you have the same position?
If the claimant had fallen, if the medical evidence was such that whether or not he fell and that caused the fracture, then yes. The doctor would testify that because he fell, it placed some sort of impact on the shoulder and therefore caused the fracture, then I would say it's work-related. I mean, the question is what the evidence suggests that supports whether or not this is a connection. Dr. Burton was offered to provide a causation analysis in terms of whether or not this medical diagnosis was caused by anything in the work environment, and that's part of the elements of work comp claim. Is it causally connected? And he said it was not.
And Mr. McDonald has pointed out that the doctor seemed to stray into making some legal opinions. Does that, do you agree with that? And if so, or do you disagree with it? And if so, assuming he's right even, does that taint his medical opinions?
I don't agree that he made a legal opinion, but even if it's considered that he did, the ALJ was going to disregard that and rely solely on the parts he believed were credible in the report, which he did. He granted the doctor's opinion on what was related and basically whether or not the activity of moving the arm caused the factor to be focused on.
There's a principle that generally applies, and I assume it's true with workers' comp law, and I'll just ask you to tell me whether I'm right or not, that the finder of fact is free to accept all of the witness's testimony, some of it or none of it. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. Yes.
I want to make sure I understand your answer to Judge Miller's question. I think what you said was that suppose the claimant had been at the premises of the employer and tripped over a chair or something and fell, and as a result, or at the time, let's take away the as a result because maybe that prejudges it, but at the time that he trips and falls, his arm breaks. Are you saying that would be compensable as opposed to the situation we have here?
I'm saying if the medical evidence suggested that the fracture or break was caused by the tripping and the falling at work, then yes, that would be a compensable condition.
And if your client had come up with the same medical testimony in that hypothetical situation, that even though we know the guy tripped and fell and hit his arm, the very arm that broke and heard a cracking sound, that if you could get a doctor to testify that didn't matter what happened anyway, you walk away free. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, assuming that of course that those facts could happen, and they want to make the argument, I suppose that's a theory that could be advanced. I think the distinction though is we didn't have a doctor saying this would have happened, eventually in the workplace. What he said was whether or not there was any stress, the fracture would have occurred, period. He didn't say that it was because of the movement of reaching or that it, or anything else caused it, just that it was caused because of a weakened bone due to the disease process that fractured, called a pathological fracture. I think that's different than if a doctor were to say, he tripped and fell, and as a result of the fall, there's a fracture of the humerus or the fracture of the arm, but that would not be related to this claim because it could have happened somewhere else. That's speculation. If it occurred at that point in time because of the fall, that's a little bit different in the case we have today.
Okay, in regard, what the doctor actually said, and I'm reading now the quote in the opening brief from his statement, the fracture occurred as it would inevitably have done due to the weakened state of the bone while the patient was performing a type of activity which is performed equally at work and off work. It's that statement suggests that the doctor believed there had to be some activity involved leading to the fracture. In other words, it wouldn't fracture while the person was just sitting there not doing anything.
That sentence was taken out of context. If you look at the entire report, he begins by saying that it would have occurred without any activity at all. And I think he was trying to explain in this case, I don't know what caused the fracture. It wasn't caused by any activity, but even if it was, it was a very minor activity that occurs anywhere. It could have occurred at home. I agree with that. But I think the issue here that the ALJ relied on was the statement that it would have occurred or did occur with or without any activity at all by the claimant. And I think that part of the report is what the ALJ relied on in supporting his order that it wasn't compensable, in addition to the diagnostic studies for the medical opinions from Alonji and Dr. Hugate, and then the fact that after this incident happened, he had two other pathologic fractures in the spine that also occurred without any typical activity. So I think those facts bolster the opinion from Dr. Burnson that it didn't require activity at all to have this fracture.
Wasn't it Dr. Alonji who said it was only a very inconsequential trauma?
He did say that.
But to me, that suggests some activity.
I think Hugate said none. But I think the fact that there were, and the judge relied on the fact that there were two other fractures in the spine that occurred after this incident that were both pathologic fractures due to the disease process, with, again, no explanation as to how they could have occurred but for the disease. And he wasn't working, he wasn't doing anything at that time. So I think if you look at the totality of the facts that Jake Lovell relied upon and not just Brogan's opinion, there's more than one opinion supporting the order that it not be found compensable in this case. And I think I'm almost out of time. Do you have any questions I can answer before I...
On this statute of limitations issue, in the reply brief, Mr. McDonald states that the statute of limitations was told here because the employer had notice of the injury but did not file the required form. Do you agree with that statement?
I don't. And the ALJ did not rule on the statute of limitations issue.
I understand that.
We argued that, in fact, the claimant had knowledge of this because he went to the employer right after the injury occurred. He filed a FMLA request form advising he had been hurt. He knew how serious this was. He was having surgery and treating from that point on, and never told the employer that he had a work-related injury at all until he filed his claim form more than, I think it was more than 3 or 4 years later. So argument was you didn't even timely request or file the claim form to seek medical benefits from us to allow us to pick a provider. We couldn't get an authorized treater on the file, so we never did get anyone who could do a little rating on the doctor authorized. We never got anyone that could treat the shoulder and do it expeditiously. It was done, you know, right over a long period of time. There was no claim for lost wages, but that should, if there had been any for TTD, it should have been there specified time timely. It was after the fact. Okay.
So, Can I ask a question?
So is it your position, if we were to set aside the order on the grounds relied upon below, is it your position we'd have to remand it for consideration of the statute of limitations issue?
I think we have to have that issue decided because the court didn't rule on that at the hearing level. And that's a critical issue regarding whether or not it's even compensable to begin with. So yes, I do.
And you're saying you would have to be remanded that we couldn't decide that?
I'm not going to rule, but I do think the ALJ has the obligation to make that ruling in the first instance.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions I can answer?
Mr. McDonald, if you'd like to take a minute to address the statute of limitations question, you're certainly welcome to do that.
May I do it from here, Your Honor?
Certainly.
Statute of limitations, first of all, it's not jurisdiction in statute of limitations. Second of all, the judge didn't rule on it. He has to rule on it. Third, in terms of the factual basis of that issue, immediately upon fracturing his arm, he called his boss in Colorado. His boss that day or the next morning flew out to Hawaii to A, help him pack and just get back to Colorado for treatment, and B, he took over for him as the superintendent on that job at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. To suggest that, gee, he never told the company anything about his injury is just absurd. And he doesn't have to use the phrase, I think this is an industrial injury. It was obvious what had happened, and it was fully reported. And that was based on the stipulated testimony of the supervisor, Mr. Petrie, who did not testify, but we agreed on his testimony. His sister had heart surgery in St. Louis, and he had to go back. Okay. That was stipulated, and it was corroborated by the claimant's testimony, and there was nothing to contradict that.
Thank you very much.
There really is a legitimate factual issue on that record.
Thank you, Mr. McCallum. And thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is deemed submitted, and an opinion will be forthcoming in due course.